And a very happy birthday today to Nordine Peterson of Wallingford, to Marvel Rosedale of Ames, and to Donna Cole of Doherty. Nordine, Marvel, and Donna, happy birthday to all of you. You are joined on your birthday today by actor Diane Wiest, who turns 76, singer Reba McEntire, who turns 69, and singer Lady Gaga, who turns 38 today. A happy birthday to all of you. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television or Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. Let me say that a little bit more slowly. I say that every time and I get kind of used to saying it. So if that number is new to you, let me say it again more slowly so that you can get it. You can give us a call at 515-243-6833. So we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. And now we're going back to obituaries. Here's Linda.
From Urbandale, Daniel Paul Wees, and that's spelled W-E-E-S, 81, of Johnston and formerly of Omaha, passed away on March 25th at Unity Point Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. Visitation for Daniel will be Monday, April 1st from 10 a.m. until the time of Mass at 11 a.m. at St. Pius Catholic Church, and that's on 66th Street in Urbandale. Luncheon will follow in the Martha and Mary Fellowship Hall. Interment will conclude at Glendale Cemetery in Des Moines. He is survived by his two sons, Jeff Wees and Doug partner Susan Wees, two grandchildren, Eli and Noah Wees, one sister, Marianne Wees, and companion, Shelley Svoboda. To view Daniel's full obituary or leave condolences, you can visit CaldwellParish.com. Paul Randleman was born in Appleton, Minnesota on December 3, 1934, and passed away on March 23rd. A celebration of life will be held on March 30th at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens, which is on Northwest 60th Avenue in Des Moines. Visitation will be at 11 a.m. and the service will take place at 11:30 a.m. with a lunch and fellowship following service. Donation may be made to the ARL, Animal Rescue League of Iowa, or the Carlisle Area Historical Society. Online condolences can be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. And from Altoona, Robert Edler, 73, passed away at home on March 25th. A visitation for family and friends will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday, March 28th, well, that would be today, at Isles Grandview Park Chapel on Hubble Avenue in Des Moines. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, tomorrow, at the chapel. Interment will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery on Monday, April 1st, at 11 a.m. Robert was born on October 12, 1950, in Marshalltown, to Howard and Harriet Mulcahy Edler. He grew up in rural Marshalltown and was a graduate of Marshalltown High School. Following high school, he was drafted into the U.S. Army and served during the Vietnam War. On June 1, 1974, he was united in marriage to Nancy Johnson in Lamoille, Iowa. They made their home in Des Moines, where they raised their two children, Angela and Jeffrey. In 2015, Robert and Nancy moved to Altoona to be closer to their children and grandchildren. Robert worked as a machinist at Emco Industries and later Townsend Plastics. His last employment was with Menards in Des Moines. Robert was a member of the Well Covenant Church in Des Moines and a lifetime member of the American Legion. He enjoyed woodworking, baking, and listening to vinyl records. He loved spending time with his grandkids and had endearing nicknames for all of them. Robert is survived by his wife, Nancy, his daughter, Angela, partner Brian Johnson, and their children, Tricia, partner Troy Sanford, Jordan, Amber, partner Sean Bish, and Connor Johnson. His son Jeffrey, partner Danielle Edler, and their children, Ellery, Elijah, and Everett, a great-grandchild, Braden Sanford, his siblings, Linda, partner Tom Wall, John, partner Doris Edler, David, partner Sandy Edler, and Jerry, partner Ellen Edler, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, cousins, and their families. He was preceded in death by his parents. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Well Covenant Church on Hubble Avenue in Des Moines. The funeral service will be recorded and available after the service on Robert's obituary page, which will be at islescares.com, where you may also leave online condolences. There is one other death notice, and that is Barbara Pohlman, 92, of Waukee, passed away on March 22nd, and it looks like her service will be in April on the 20th.
We have one article remaining in the Metro and Iowa section before we return to the front page section. This one is headlined, June 15 NASCAR Xfinity Series race at the Iowa Speedway is a sellout. The next NASCAR Xfinity Series race, scheduled for June 15 at Iowa Speedway in Newton, which is part of a weekend that culminates in Iowa's first NASCAR Cup Series race, has sold out, NASCAR announced on Wednesday. The Xfinity Series, one step below the top-level Cup Series, is scheduled for 2:30 p.m. June 15. The June 16 Cup Series race sold out in December. NASCAR's News Large Series, a lower-level developmental race set for 7 p.m. June 14. Cup Series cars will be on the track that Friday and the following day for practice and qualifying, as well as for the Sunday race. From 2009 to 2019, the Iowa Speedway hosted 20 Xfinity Series and 13 NASCAR Truck Series races, but the track fell off the series schedule after the COVID-19 pandemic reached Iowa in 2020. In October, NASCAR surprised fans by announcing Iowa Speedway would get the first Cup Series date after the previous site, Auto Club Speedway in Fontana, California, closed last year for renovations. On Wednesday, NASCAR also announced that West Des Moines-based Hy-Vee will be the title sponsor of the Xfinity Series race. Since 2022, Hy-Vee has sponsored and promoted two annual NTT IndyCar Series races at Iowa Speedway. Hy-Vee, which has invested heavily in motorsports in recent years, also will serve as the title sponsor of two IndyCar races in Milwaukee this summer. In September 2022, the company served as the primary sponsor of an Xfinity Series car during a race in Kansas Speedway at Kansas City, Kansas. The companies also announced that Hy-Vee would extend its sponsorship to Kansas Speedway as part of the deal. The chain has about a dozen stores in the Kansas City metro area. Hy-Vee has long been a tremendous supporter of Iowa Speedway, and we are thrilled we're joining our historic upcoming NASCAR weekend in a major way, Iowa Speedway President Eric Peterson said in a news release. Hy-Vee plays a vital role in the communities in our state and our region, so their involvement is yet another sign that everyone is rallying behind the return of NASCAR racing to Iowa.
That concludes the Metro section articles. Going back to the main section, U.S. Appeals Court keeps Texas border law on hold. A federal appeals court has kept on hold a Republican-backed Texas law that would let state authorities arrest and prosecute people suspected of illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, a statute that President Joe Biden's administration has argued intrudes on the authority of the federal government. In a 2-1 ruling late Tuesday, a panel of the New Orleans-based 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals denied a request by Texas to let the law take effect while the state's appeal of a judge's ruling blocking it plays out. The law, SB 4, has become a flashpoint in a broader battle between Texas and the Biden administration over border security and immigration. It would make it a state crime to illegally enter or re-enter Texas from a foreign country and would empower state judges to order that violators leave the United States, with prison sentences up to 20 years for those who refuse to comply. The Fifth Circuit panel's action was the latest of three rapid-fire rulings on the status of the law. The Supreme Court last week let it take effect, but the Fifth Circuit panel hours later restored U.S. District Judge David Ezra's February injunction blocking enforcement. Ezra, based in Austin, Texas, cited a 2012 U.S. Supreme Court ruling involving an Arizona law that held that states cannot adopt immigration enforcement measures that clash with federal law. The Fifth Circuit panel is scheduled to hear arguments on the merits of the state's appeal on April 3rd. Circuit Judge Andrew Oldham, an appointee of Republican former President Donald Trump, who dissented in Tuesday's decision, predicted that the panel would uphold the ruling blocking SB 4 over his objections. Today's decision means that we'll likely never know how Texas's state courts and its state law enforcement officers would have implemented SB 4. The judge wrote in his dissenting opinion. The U.S. Department of Justice and the Office of Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Civil rights groups that joined the Biden administration in challenging the law praised Tuesday's ruling, saying it will temporarily prevent Texas authorities from violating migrants' rights and potentially engaging in racial profiling. This unconstitutional proposal should never have gotten this far, and we look forward to the courts blocking it permanently so we can get back to discussing real policy solutions, Edna Yang, co-executive director of the group American Gateways, said in a statement. The lawsuit filed in January argued that the measure violates the U.S. Constitution and federal law by interfering with the U.S. government's power to regulate immigration, as well as running afoul of the 2012 Supreme Court decision. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a fierce Republican critic of President Joe Biden's immigration policies, signed the law in December, saying it was a necessary step to address an increase in illegal entries.
Former presidents joining Biden for a fundraiser. The stars are coming out for President Joe Biden's campaign fundraiser Thursday with former presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. Stephen Colbert, host of CBS's The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, will moderate what they're calling an armchair conversation with Biden, Obama, and Clinton at the high-dollar event at Radio City Music Hall in New York, according to the campaign. Actress Mindy Kaling, who starred in The Office and The Mindy Project, is set to host the evening. The evening will feature musical guests Lizzo, Queen Latifah, Ben Platt, Cynthia Erivo, and Lea Michele. The fundraiser is expected to be the most lucrative to date for Biden's reelection campaign, which has significantly outraised former President Donald Trump, who Biden likely will face in November. Fundraiser guests who pay enough can have their portrait taken with the three presidents by world-renowned photographer Annie Leibovitz, known for her pictures of celebrities. Donors can also take part in a virtual conversation with the three presidents, moderated by Biden campaign manager Julie Chavez Rodriguez. The event is expected to raise at least $10 million and draw at least 3,000 people. Chris Korge, a veteran Democratic fundraiser and finance chair of the Biden Victory Fund, told NBC News. A photograph with all three presidents will start at $100,000, NBC reported, but the tickets to attend the program go for as little as $250 each. Korge has organized the fundraiser alongside DreamWorks founder Jeffrey Katzenberg, the campaign's co-chair, Rufus Gilford, the campaign finance chair, and Anna Wintour, U.S. artistic director of Condé Nast. The Biden campaign and other joint committees raised $53 million in February, giving the incumbent president $155 million on hand to spend, the most ever for a Democratic candidate at this point in the election cycle.
Case brings skeptical justices together. The Supreme Court considers suit against abortion pill. A Supreme Court bitterly divided 2 years ago over the right to an abortion appeared to find something close to unity Tuesday as conservative and liberal justices took turns picking apart the arguments of a small group of anti-abortion doctors seeking to roll back access to the widely used abortion drug mifepristone. Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Donald Trump appointee who voted in 2022 to overturn the constitutional right to an abortion, groused that a handful of individuals were trying to make health policy for the entire country. The case, Gorsuch said, seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on a FDA rule or any other federal government action. Tuesday's arguments were a big speed bump for a crucial abortion case that had so far sailed through lower courts with key arguments intact. The case sent shockwaves across the medical and legal worlds last year when a Trump-appointed district judge in Amarillo, Texas, suspended the FDA's 20-year-old approval of mifepristone. The right-leaning Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Louisiana restored the FDA's approval but upheld other parts of his decision, setting the stage for a high court showdown that saw strident anti-abortion and abortion rights protesters facing off on the streets outside. The hearing generated intense interest in part because the doctors have sought to use the Comstock Act, a 19th century anti-obscenity law, to ban the delivery of mifepristone by mail. But with the exception of Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, the court mostly ignored the 1873 law and focused on the anti-abortion doctors. The Supreme Court has experienced strong divisions over recent cases involving issues including abortion, affirmative action, and gun rights. But there were moments Tuesday when the justices seemed to line up to get in their own skeptical questions about the doctors standing to sue, the board restrictions they demanded, and whether the FDA's decision can be second-guessed by the judiciary. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson pressed Aaron Hawley, the doctor's attorney, to provide an example of an anti-abortion physician who had been forced to violate their ethics by treating a woman suffering from a mifepristone-related emergency. Hawley replied that she couldn't because doctors don't necessarily know until they scrub in to that operating room whether this may or may not be abortion drug harm. It could be a miscarriage, it could be an ectopic pregnancy, or it could be an elective abortion. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloger had earlier told the court the doctor's argument was, quote, unduly speculative. We think that the situation has never come to pass, she said. The doctors haven't identified any incident in more than 20 years that mifepristone has been available on the market that resembles that kind of hypothetical situation. Justice Clarence Thomas, who voted last year to roll back the drug's availability while Tuesday's case was being litigated, went after the doctors' claim that the very fact that they felt compelled to sue counted as an injury requiring the court's intervention. That would be anyone who is aggressive or vigilant about bringing lawsuits just simply by using resources to advocate their position in court. You say now causes an injury. That seems easy to manufacture, Thomas said. Hawley, who is married to Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, said this case was different because the doctors had analyzed studies and combed through FDA data. Is that it? Justice Amy Coney Barrett later asked. Cora True Frost, a Syracuse University law professor, said that by tackling the apparent weaknesses in the doctors standing to sue and the broad remedies they demanded, the court was avoiding the knottier question of whether the judiciary should have a say in science-based decisions like the approval of drugs by the FDA. For the court to engage the merits of those arguments, they would be substituting their judgment for those of the experts at the FDA, True Foss told the USA Today. Focusing on the threshold issue of standing in a classic judicial move to conserve court resources and avoid making cases the court would rather not make. The justices seemed most rankled by Hawley's argument that the only way to safeguard the rights of the anti-abortion doctors was to restrict the use of mifepristone nationwide, where it is used in the majority of U.S. abortions. They're saying, because we object to having to be forced to participate in this procedure, we're seeking an order preventing anyone from having access to these drugs at all, Jackson said. And I guess I'm just trying to understand how they could possibly be entitled to that, given the injury that they have alleged. Chief Justice John Roberts asked why the case couldn't be limited to the people involved in one region rather than blocking the FDA from allowing the drug everywhere. I think it might be impracticable, Hawley said, because the FDA regulation would remain in place and permit things like mail order abortions.
And in a related court case, abortion and in vitro fertilization are the focus of a state house race in Alabama. Democrat Marilyn Lands won a contentious special election for a state house seat in Deep Red, Alabama on Tuesday night. The results could signal the dominant role of abortion and in vitro fertilization in elections across the country in 2024. Lands, a licensed professional counselor, beat Republican Teddy Powell, a city council member, in the race for a seat in Alabama's state house that was left vacant after former Republican Representative David Cole pleaded guilty to voter fraud. Lands ran against Cole in 2022 for the 10th district seat, which covers an area around Huntsville, but lost by 7 points. While her win will not change the makeup of the heavily Republican Alabama legislature, it does showcase the enormous impact reproductive issues such as abortion and in vitro fertilization could have down the ballot this fall. The election was one of the first tests of how Alabama voters felt about the state court's February ruling, which threatened access to IVF, the in vitro fertilization, when it found that frozen embryos were legally considered children. The state's legislature weighed in on the issue in early March with a law attempting to protect IVF providers and patients from prosecution. Alabama is also one of several states where a strict abortion ban went into effect after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. The Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, an organization that works to elect Democrats to state houses, saw the 10th district race as a test of the influence reproductive issues could have on swing voters across the country in 2024. Lands focused her campaign heavily on protecting abortion and IVF access. In a TV ad, Lands shared her experience getting an abortion for a non-viable pregnancy years ago with an Alabama woman who recently faced a similar situation but had to travel out of state to receive the procedure because of the state's abortion ban after the Dobbs v. Jackson's Women's Health Organization decision. Lenz argued that her state's new law that aimed to protect IVF providers and patients from prosecution fell short and did not address the root concerns with the court's decision. The approach ultimately proved successful against Powell, who campaigned mainly on infrastructure and the economy. While Powell expressed support for IVF access, he argued that it was different from abortion. He also criticized Lenz for defining the 10th district race around reproductive issues. "I'm not sure any race can or should be about a single issue," he told USA Today. "Our district has many challenges that we're facing that are not related at all to this specific issue," he added. The race could be a microcosm for broader 2024 election trends. Republican candidates across the country, including presumptive GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump, are campaigning on issues such as immigration and the economy. They believe that inflation and national security are among the most salient issues for voters this year. Democrats, meanwhile, see abortion as a key motivating issue for voters based on a string of ballot measures successes since the 2022 midterms. The Alabama race is among the first data points this year signaling which issues have the most impact, and the results nod in favor of Democrats.
The Pope appears in better health ahead of Easter. Pope Francis, whose frail health has been a growing source of concern in recent weeks, appeared in better shape on Wednesday ahead of a busy Easter week schedule. The 87-year-old pontiff read out in full prepared texts for his weekly audience, rather than delegating an aide to read most of them, as he had done in the previous 4 weeks, and he made a few off-the-cuff remarks. Francis made fresh appeals for peace in Ukraine and the Middle East and publicly greeted two men in the audience, one Israeli and one Palestinian, who have both lost daughters in the long-running Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He described them as two friends who love one another and who have experienced the same crucifixion. The Pope, who is in daily phone contact with a Catholic parish in Gaza, also wrote an open letter to Catholics in the Middle East, expressing sympathy, your sufferings and your struggles, particularly in the course of these recent months. The Pope has been suffering on and off from what has been described as a cold, bronchitis, and influenza for more than a month, leading him to limit public speaking, cancel some meetings, and visit a hospital for medical checks. Concerns about his condition were renewed 3 days ago when he skipped his homily at a Palm Sunday service in St. Peter's Square. The pontiff is due to preside over a number of religious services and ceremonies leading up to Easter on Sunday, including a washing of the feet ritual in a women's prison in Rome on Thursday. Easter is the most important festival in the Christian calendar, celebrating the day in which Christians believe Jesus rose from the dead.
And we'll wrap up this shift with a few items from USA Today's 50-state roundup. We'll start with the highlight, which was from Rhode Island, Providence. The Roger Williams Park Zoo says it has bought a bit of the Himalayas to Providence to make its two red pandas comfortable. With a ceremonial bamboo cutting last week, the zoo opened its cutting-edge habitat for red pandas Kenji and Zan. The zoo says the new habitat, which cost $1.47 million and took 9 months to design and build, prioritizes optimal animal welfare and comfort while offering enriching experiences for visitors of all ages. The habitat also includes a two-story outdoor space featuring climbing structures and multiple viewing areas, according to the zoo. Turning now to Chicago, Illinois, as Chicago begins evicting migrants from shelters, lawmakers in Springfield are weighing new spending. By the end of April, the Chicago Tribune reports the city plans to evict 2,000 migrants after a 60-day shelter stay limit went into effect earlier last week. From Minnesota in St. Paul, earlier this week, the Biden campaign signaled that Minnesota will be a key state to win in November by beefing up its state campaign. Ron Harris, Alana Peterson, and Justin Bione will join the Biden-Harris campaign team leading its Minnesota operation. And finally, from Lincoln, Nebraska, advocates are saying that a $15 million reduction in state funding will lead to added strain on local hospitals and jails and more problems for Nebraskans. That's a report from the Lincoln Star-Journal. And that brings us to the end of our shift. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Linda Lundgren and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Patty Daniels and Bob Wagner. We will continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Bob with our first article.
Out of the opinion section, the title is Clark Seizes Records But Gender Gap Remains by Claudia Schabel. It's hard to miss her. Her image has popped up on billboards in multiple cities, on cereal boxes, insurance and shoe ads, and scores of t-shirts. She's all over the internet. Her endorsements include Panini, H&R Block, Nike, Buick, State Farm, Gatorade, and more. University of Iowa Hawkeyes women's basketball point guard Caitlin Clark has caused a ticket sellout nearly everywhere she and her team have played this season, with ticket prices reaching record high prices. Every Hawkeye home game has been a sellout this year, a new twist in women's basketball anywhere. In the Big Ten's conference alone, almost every women's team has seen up to four times its regular attendance figures when the Hawkeyes are in town. She's changed the sport by bringing in droves of new fans of all genders and backgrounds. Never has a single player in college women's sports caused such a fan frenzy. It's not even close. Here's a small sample of the records racked up by Iowa's number 22. Most career points in Division I history for men and women. First Division I player, men or women, to have 3,000 or more points, 900 or more assists, and 800 or more rebounds in a career. 56 30-point games, the most by a Division I player in the past 25 seasons. 12 40-point games, the most by a Division I player in the past 25 seasons. Most single-season three-pointers in Division I history for men and women. Even non-basketball fans are impressed by a woman breaking records held by male stars. Through it all, Clark maintains an even demeanor, not hiding her prowess, but embracing her influence. She signs as many autographs as possible after every game for the hordes of younger kids of all genders who idolize her. Clark views its accessibility as a positive. "I'm all about growing the women's game," Clark said after a win over Indiana in the regular season finale last month. "And I'm glad I've given something that little girls can scream about at the top of their lungs." When Clark announced her decision to go pro after this season, the story topped sports pages across the country. Her popularity affects and reflects women's rising power in sports marketing, especially since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 3 years ago that student athletes can market and earn money from their name, image, and likeness, known as NIL. The NIL change is especially empowering for female athletes whose post-college professional path is historically far less lucrative than men's. Now, with Clark, the Women's National Basketball Association, WNBA, has a chance to draw new crowds. The Indiana Fever, the team likely to draft Clark, and all their opponents will likely see early upticks in attendance when the Fever hit town. She's a golden goose for the league. The WNBA can use the Clark effect to showcase its high level of play and hopefully gain traction in a quest for parity with the National Basketball Association's Men's League. During the 2022-23 season, the 30 franchises comprising the NBA recorded total revenue of $10.58 billion. As of 2022, the WNBA reportedly generated $60 million. Hardly comparable, but a big step for the Women's League, further proving the growth of their game. Slowly, WNBA salaries are rising. Significant work still needs to be done to achieve gender equality and opportunity for women in the sports world. Besides pay, women in sports still trail men when it comes to media coverage, sponsorship opportunities, representation in leadership roles such as coaching and administration, and access to resources and facilities. The sports world is but a microcosm of the inequality and disparities in pay and opportunities for women in this country. Women are often subject to social expectations and norms that dictate their behavior and limit their autonomy and freedom. While progress has been made, there is still much work to be done to achieve full gender equality for women in America. Some of the disparities that remain include economic. Women are still paid less than men for the same work and are underrepresented in higher paying and leadership positions. Political. Women are underrepresented in political leadership positions and face barriers to running for office and participating in decision-making processes. Legal. Women remain challenged by laws that discriminate against them in cases of divorce, inheritance, and domestic violence. Clark has used some of her earnings to create the Caitlin Clark Foundation. The mission? Uplift and improve the lives of youths and their communities through education, nutrition, and sport. Three pillars Caitlin believes are foundational in her success. Her example inspires girls and women to follow her lead in breaking through barriers that continue to challenge American women daily and help close the generation gap, still as wide as the arc of one of number 22's from the logo three-pointers. Patty?
Thank you, Bob. Not turned on by March Madness? You're not alone. And Rex Hupke has written this editorial. "There's a problem I've lived with my entire life, and I'm heroically opening up about it today. I don't like March Madness. My goal in disclosing this deeply personal information is not to draw attention to myself, but to let others who might feel the same know they're not alone. You're welcome. To be clear, I have nothing against college basketball or the NCAA tournament or anyone who loves March Madness. I'm happy for all involved. Enjoy your month. Go basketball. Eat snacks. I just don't share the excitement. I went to a smaller university that had a decidedly meh basketball program, so I don't have an attachment to any particular team. Perhaps more important, I pay no attention to the college basketball season, so come tournament time, asking me to fill out a bracket is like asking me to solve the Schrödinger equation, which I only know about because I Googled most complicated mathematical equations. So I spend the month in a bracketless as a bracketless weirdo, and still I am asked no fewer than 1,345,299 times how my bracket is doing, because those who love March Madness assume all humans love March Madness. When I say, oh, I don't do a bracket, I really don't follow college hoops, people look at me like I just descended from a hovering spacecraft and am unfamiliar with the ways of Earthlings. The only bracket I've ever busted is the one I hang my weed whacker on in the garage, and that was only because I tripped over a bucket trying to put it back. Beyond bracket chatter, the airwaves and news headlines throughout March are filled with talk of Cinderellas and upsets and something called the Gonzaga and a multitude of colleges and universities I refuse to believe actually exist. Duquesne? I'm pretty sure that's a French dessert. And for those of us who don't stop working for several weeks to enjoy the tournament and talk about the tournament and read things about the tournament and ask people who don't fill out brackets how their brackets are doing, March Madness lasts almost literally forever. And during that time, nothing else matters. Again, I mean no offense whatever to those who live for tournament time. But for people like me, man, we need something. There are only 12 months in the year, and to spend one of those months not caring about the one thing everyone else is caring about is just not healthy. That's why today I'm calling on my fellow March Madness non-enthusiasts to step forward and let yourselves be seen. Don't pretend to completely fill out a bracket just to fit in. Say, no, it's just not my thing. Once you do that, perhaps we can all can come together and figure out what our thing is. Our March thing. The thing we want to choose over and talk about constantly and celebrate by eating too much food and losing money. Maybe it'll be a contest to see who can write the worst emo poetry about the month of March. We can call it March Sadness. Or maybe a competition among popular regional sandwiches, from Buffalo's beef 1 week to California's French dip munch sandwich. Well, we can just rewatch old seasons of Survivor, for all I care. March probusiness. We just need something. I hope my public admission today helps others open up about their NCAA basketball ennui. Together, we can get through this month, and when it's over, we'll all celebrate with a generous slice of Duquesne with extra whipped cream. And you can follow USA Today columnist Russ Hupke on X, formerly Twitter, and you can reach him at Rex Hupke.
Thank you, Patty. Now we'll turn to sports. Believe it or not, even though it's basketball season, there is interesting college news. Three interesting quotes from Kirk Ferentz news conference by Chad Listicow out of Iowa City. Kirk Ferentz's typical news conference to kick off spring football got pushed back 7 days with so much sports activity already going on last week in Iowa City between the men's NIT and women's NCAA tournament. So on Tuesday, Ferentz, for the first time, addressed his 2024 football team, already having 1 week of spring practice in the books. and in his opening statement, he seemed to relish the lack of attention his program has received the past 2 months since Tim Lester was hired as offensive coordinator. "It has been a while," Frantz said. "Everybody here has been busy covering a lot of good success stories. We've been quiet for a while, too, which isn't all bad." Early on, Ferentz addressed the arrival and departure of offensive tackle Caden Proctor without ever saying his name, adding these strong words, "If there's a silver lining here, we didn't spend any practice reps with someone who had no intention of being here, and that's a positive." The offense is where all the biggest question marks for the Hawkeyes are this spring, this summer, and this fall. We'll continue to learn more about the quarterback situation and the Lester offense as we go. On that note, here were probably the three most notable quotes from Ferentz during his 30-minute news conference. First one, "We're just taking his playbook material and going with it." What's that we hear? A round of applause for Hawkeye from Hawkeye Nation? That comment was made about how Lester is constructing things while taking over college football's worst Power 5 offense in each of the last 2 years. There was some trepidation that Lester, a six-year Western Michigan head coach who spent last season with the Green Bay Packers, would cater to whatever Ferentz wanted, but it appears he does have the keys to the offense. Now, there might be a restrictor plate on the engine, but Lester at least has a license to drive this thing where he wants. That's the good news. The bad news, and this should be expected, is that installing a fresh offense doesn't happen instantly. It's been a process, Ferentz said. We're trying to install something each and every day. It's been challenging, I think, for everybody, and myself included, just learning the language and trying to keep up. Ferentz said Lester has been a good fit personally and professionally. Remember, this is only the second outside hire that Ferentz has made at offensive coordinator since 1999. So Lester came with some unknowns. Not repeating Greg Davis's disastrous first season of 2012 is a must. Considering Iowa should have a playoff-caliber defense, there's urgency in making sure 2024 is productive offensively. I think it's going to look different, Ferentz said, but stressed that Iowa will still emphasize complementary football led by a strong defense. I think philosophically we're in line. Not being reckless with the football is a big part of that, and being good on special teams, that's been a big part of our blueprint. Stats are great and all that, but the most important stat is winning games, and that has been the first and foremost. And my visits with Tim, I think that's where he's at, too. I think the same way, and he gets it. He gets how things work together. The second quote, "I would like to think in June he will be full speed to do everything." That was Ferentz on quarterback Cade McNamara, who suffered a torn ACL during Iowa's September 30th home game against Michigan State. That seems like a really good prognosis for the six-year senior. Brief practice videos on social media have shown McNamara in the pocket throwing passes, but Ferentz cautioned that he won't be doing much this spring. He can throw the football standing, but he can't really move back, moving around or dropping, that type of deal, Ferentz said. I have a harness on him because he's always anxious to do a little bit more than what he probably should. What we want to do is go backward. A June return would give him nearly 3 months to get prepped for the August 31st opening versus Illinois State. Deacon Hill was listed number 2 on Tuesday's release depth chart, and Marco Lance number 3. But that doesn't really mean anything right now. Hopefully, as spring ball goes on, we'll get a better sense of how Iowa feels about its quarterback room. Really interested in all the positions on our team, Ferentz said, but really curious to see how the two guys competing right now at quarterback look at the end of spring ball. Unless Hill or Linez wows in spring ball, Iowa would need to hit a transfer portal. Depth is crucial at quarterback, given McNamara's injury history and how rough the offense was with Hill at the helm, capped by a 35-0 loss to Tennessee in the Citrus Bowl. His third quote, "We haven't been as good up front as we've been in years past." That is about Iowa's offensive line. And yes, we know that just by watching the lack of consistent production in the running game and the constant punts, by coming out of Iowa's February self-scouting sessions, at least the head coach saw the poor play was at the root of Iowa's offensive problems. It's tough to operate offensively within most systems if you don't block as well as you like, Ferentz said. Losing Proctor, a 14-game starter at left tackle for Alabama last season, doesn't help. For now, Mason Richmond is at the left tackle again, with Jennings Dunker at the right tackle and Nick DeJong as a swing tackle who could kick inside to guard. Center Logan Jones is out this spring after surgery. Three others on the line have starting experience, guards Bo Steffens and Connor Colby, and center Tyler Ellsbury. Those seven offensive linemen have combined 150 college starts. A lot of those were poor starts, but Ferentz is banking on their experience to pay off. Iowa will need some good developmental stories to join the veteran group. Redshirt freshman Trevor Locke and Cade Piper appeared on Tuesday's depth chart as second-team guards. We have an opportunity maybe to develop into a good line because we do have pretty good experience, Ferentz said. I think we have good leadership in there too, and that's paramount to any group, any team. It's just a matter of making the steps in front of them and just keep working. The guys are out there right now are working hard and doing a good job. Back to you, Patty.
Thank you, Bob. This is college men's basketball. Excuse me. Drake star DeVries enters transfer portal. Written for us by Alyssa Hartel. Drake basketball officially lost the biggest piece of the puzzle on Wednesday when Tucker DeVries, son of former Buildings coach Darian DeVries, entered the transfer portal. On3 Sports was the first to report the news. These reports come a day after DeVries was scheduled to undergo shoulder surgery, which he confirmed to the Register in a text message on Sunday. It has been an issue for a majority of the season, DeVries told the Register. I'm just thankful I was able to complete the season, even though I was very limited on certain things. I wasn't able to practice much and had to be cautious of what I was doing in games, but I wanted to do what I could to help the team in any way possible instead of sitting out. It is expected but not confirmed that he will follow his father to West Virginia. Tucker DeVries made an immediate impact starting as a true freshman at Drake. In his junior season, DeVries averaged 21.6 points, 6.7 rebounds, and 3.7 assists per game. His 53 steals were a career high. DeVries started all but one game, a non-conference matchup against Alcom State, helping Drake to a 28-7 overall record, a 16-4 record against conference opponents, and the Bulldogs' second straight Missouri Valley Conference Tournament championship. He led Drake to back-to-back berths in the NCAA tournament as well. DeVries ends his time in the MVC as a two-time Larry Bird Trophy Award winner, given to the league's Player of the Year. He is only the ninth player in conference history to earn the honor 2 years in a row. More Bulldog players are expected to hit the transfer portal after West Virginia announced it had hired Darian DeVries as its new head basketball coach on Sunday night. DeVries compiled a 150-55 overall record in six seasons at Drake, including back-to-back Missouri Valley Conference championships and automatic berths in the NCAA tournament in 2023 and 2024. Dear Abby is next, and I'll just go ahead and read this. Long-time friendship entails frequent visits from couple. My husband is an outdoor enthusiast and has a group of guys he goes hunting with every year. One of them has started coming out west to vacation at our house twice a year and now has followed us to our warm weather winter home. When he stays at our place, we fix all the meals, and he uses our washer, dryer, and detergents for several loads of laundry each time. He's a longtime friend and brings his spouse, with whom I get along well. But as time goes on, their visits are becoming more frequent and longer in length. Always being the host and entertaining makes me anxious. My husband can't seem to understand what my issue is when I try to talk with him about it. But I feel that seeing these folks a couple times a year is more than enough to keep the friendship going. How can I get my husband to understand my side without ruining the friendship? Signed, Hosted Out. Dear Hosted Out, these people may be friends, but your hospitality is being taken advantage of. Try once more to explain to your husband that their visits are happening too often. However, if he doesn't accept it, then arrange a vacation for yourself the next time they are expected to arrive. By this, I mean pack a bag and go to a hotel. Perhaps when your husband has to assume all the responsibility for these freeloading friends, he will see the light. I can't believe the wife would let you do all the work by yourself. How lazy and insensitive of her not to volunteer. Dear Abby, my sister, Maggie, has turned into one of those crazy cat ladies. We have been encouraging her to move into assisted living, but she said she'd rather be dead than give up her cats. When we visit her, we bring along air freshener. Maggie has gone nose blind to the smell and argues her house does not stink. My wife will not walk in until after I have sprayed the house. Among Maggie's other issues, her children have abandoned her. We had to hire people to help her out because no one in her son's family would take the job. When my mother got sick, my wife and I stepped up and gave her 24/7 care. Taking care of my sister was not part of my retirement plan. Her retired son and his family not doing their part has caused a rift between us. Please advise. Signed, Above and Beyond in the South. Dear A and B, what a caring and responsible brother you are. If there are no alternatives, it appears you may be taking care of Maggie until her passing. That her son has shirked his responsibility is disgraceful. It may also be elder abuse. Your sister may be unaware of the fact that some assisted living places do allow residents to have pets. Maggie might be more amenable to moving if you can help her find one. However, if that isn't feasible, consider discussing this with an attorney as well as Adult Protective Services. And you can contact Dear Abby at dearabby.com. That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Bob Wagner. Earlier, you heard Twyla Glenn and Linda Lundgren. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRA's.